said as we came nearer. Why aren't you engaged in study and prayer?
We could ask the same of you, I said, assailed by the uneasy feeling he'd been waiting for us.
I've been at prayer here beneath the tree.
Diodora bristled.
And we've been at prayer up there on the cliffs.
I gave her an approving look.
The rocks up there are treacherous, and there are wild animals, he said. We would all be saddened if you came to harm.
His face had such a quiet malevolence that I looked away. He seemed to be threatening us, but I was unsure how.
We feel safe enough there, I told him and attempted to pass. The words, "she is everything," were like a fire in me. I had no time for him.
He stepped to block the path.
When you are in need of a walk, it would be safer to travel down the hill and along the road to the lake. There are solitary places on the shore that are as beautiful as the sea. I will be glad to show you.
Ah, that was it. The lake lay down the hill and across the road, just beyond the protection of the Therapeutes precinct. I said, "The lake sounds like a pleasant place to pray. We'll go there another time. Right now, we have duties to attend."
He smiled. I smiled back. "Don't attempt to go to the lake," I told Diodora when we were some distance away.
"You've just met Lucian, Haran's spy. He means to lure us onto the road where the militia wait to arrest us. The boy who brings the salt said the soldiers stop everyone who passes from the west, looking for an old woman with a drooped eye and a young woman with unruly curls. They could easily mistake you for me."
My words sobered her.
When we arrived at our hut, we found Yaltha sitting in her spot in the courtyard reading a codex from the library. Seeing her, Diodora said quietly to me, "It isn't merely a question of whether Yaltha will choose to go to Galilee or stay in Egypt, is it? It's whether any of us will be able to leave at all." She'd spoken my fear out loud. Leaving Diodora and Yaltha in the courtyard, I cleansed my hands and face in preparation to enter the holy room and write the hymn that was burning a hole in my heart. I set the lamp on the table and poured ink into the palette. I dipped my pen. 23. The 49th day vigil began the next day at sunset. I arrived late to find the dining hall ablaze with lamps. The seniors already reclined on their couches, eating. The juniors were hauling about platters of food. Diodora was at the serving table, replenishing a tray of fish and hen eggs. "Sister," she cried as I approached, "where have you been?" I held up the scroll that contained my opus. I was finalizing the words of my hymn. "Lucian has been inquiring of your whereabouts. He has twice pointed out your absence to Skepsis." I picked up a serving bowl of pomegranate seeds. "It is good of him to miss me." She smiled and rolled her eyes at her platter. "I've refilled it 4 times. Let us hope they leave a morsel for us." Though Yaltha had been designated as a junior, I noticed Skepsis had allowed her to recline on one of the couches reserved for seniors. Lucian left his couch and stood before Skepsis.
"Yaltha should be serving us alongside the other juniors," he said angrily, his voice carrying across the room.
"Anger is effortless, Lucian. Kindness is hard. Try to exert yourself."
"She shouldn't be here at all," he persisted.
Skepsis waved her hand. "Leave me to eat in peace." I looked at Yaltha, who was biting a turnip, unfazed. When the banqueting wore down, the community made their way to the opposite end of the room, where a waist-high partition ran along the center with benches on each side, women to the left, men to the right. I sat on the last bench with Yaltha and Diodora.
"Get comfortable," Yaltha told us. "You'll be here the rest of the night."
"All night?" Diodora exclaimed.
"Yes, but you will not lack for entertainment," Yaltha said.
Coming behind us and overhearing, Skepsis said, "Our gathering is not entertainment, as Yaltha well knows. It's a vigil. We watch for the dawn, which represents the true light of God. And we will sing ourselves into a stupor before it arrives," Yaltha said.
"Yes, that part is true," Skepsis conceded.
Skepsis began the vigil with a lengthy discourse, about what precisely I couldn't say. I gripped the scroll on which I'd written my hymn. My song suddenly seemed too audacious. I heard Skepsis call my name. "Anna, come, Offer your hymn to Sophia. I call my hymn Thunder, Perfect Mind, I told her when I reached the front of the room. Someone struck a timbrel. As the drumbeat began, I lifted my scroll and chanted. I was sent out from power. Be careful. Do not ignore me. I am the first and the last. I am she who is honored and she who is mocked. I am the whore and the holy woman. I am the wife and the virgin. I am the mother and the daughter. I stopped and looked at their faces, glimpsing both wonder and bewilderment. Diadora was watching me intensely, her hands tucked under her chin. A smile moved on Yaltha's lips. I felt all the women who lived inside me. Do not stare at me in the shit pile, leaving me discarded. You will find me in the kingdoms. Do not be afraid of my power. Why do you despise my fear and curse my pride? I am she who exists in all fears and in trembling boldness. I paused once more, needing to find my breath. The words I'd sung seemed to swirl over my head. I wondered where they had come from, where they would go. I am without God, and I am she whose God is magnificent. I am being. I am she who is nothing. I am the coming together and the falling apart. I am the enduring and the disintegration. I am what everyone can hear and no one can say. I sang on and on, and when the hymn was ended, I walked slowly back to my place. As I passed the benches, a woman rose to her feet and then another, until everyone was standing. I looked uncertainly at Skepsis. They are telling you that you are Sophia's daughter, she said. They are telling you she is well pleased. I remember the rest of that night only vaguely. I know we sang without ceasing, first the men, then the women, blending finally into a single choir. The sistrums shook and the goatskin drums beat. We danced, pretending to cross the Red Sea, wheeling and counterwheeling, exhausted and delirious, until dawn came and we turned east and faced the light. 24. One afternoon near the end of winter, Skepsis arrived unexpectedly in my holy room with swatches of leather, papyri, a measuring rod, needles, thread, wax, and a huge pair of scissors. We're going to turn your scrolls into codices, she said. A bound book is the best way to ensure your writing endures. She didn't wait for my consent, which I would have given 100 times over, but she set about spreading her bookmaking wares across the table. The scissors were identical to the ones I'd used to cut Jesus' hair the day I'd told him I was with child. With which scrolls do you wish to begin? She asked. I heard her, but I could not stop looking at the long bronze scissor blades. The remembrance of them caused a toppling sensation in my chest. Anna? She said. Shaking my head to clear the memory, I retrieved the scrolls that contained my stories of the matriarchs and placed them on the table. I wish to begin at the beginning. Watch carefully and learn. I'll show you how to make the first book, but the rest you must do yourself. She measured and marked the scrolls and the leather cover. When she cut them, I closed my eyes, remembering the sound of the shears, the feel of his hair in my fingers. See, I did not injure a single one of your words, she said when she was done, seeming to mistake my preoccupation as concern over her cutting skills. I did not correct her. Holding up a blank page of papyrus, she added, I've cut an extra page so you may write a title on it. Then she began to sew the pages together inside the leather covers. Now, she said, what is it that troubles you, Anna? Is it Haran? I hesitated. I had poured out my fears and longings to Yaltha and Diadora, but not to Skepsis. I said, when spring comes, it will be 2 years since I've seen my husband. She smiled slightly. I see. My brother promised to send a letter when it was safe for me to return to Galilee. There's a servant in Haran's house who will bring it to me, but Haran will prevent my leaving. It seemed impossible that the Jewish militia was still posted on the road after all these months. Their encampment had become a permanent outpost. Skepsis pushed and pulled the needle, using a little iron hammer to force it through the leather. She said, the salt boy tells me the soldiers have built a small stone hut in which to sleep, as well as a pen for a goat, and they've hired a local woman to cook their meals.
It's a testament to Haran's patience and need for revenge. I had heard these things from Yaltha. Hearing them again left me even more disconsolate. I don't know why the letter hasn't come, I said, but I don't feel I can tarry here much longer. Do you see how I'm making a backstitch to make a double knot? She asked, all of her attention refocused on the book. I said nothing more. When the codex was completed, she placed it in my arms. If your letter comes, I'll do what I can to help you leave, she said. But it will sadden me to see you go. If your place is in Galilee, Anna, so be it. I only wish you to know that this place will be here if you desire to return. She left. I looked down at the codex, this thing of wonder. 25. Then came a day balmy with spring. I had just finished turning the last of my scrolls into books, a task I'd worked on for weeks with an exigency I couldn't explain. Now, alone in the house, I surveyed the stack of codices with relief, then amazement. Perhaps my words would endure now. Yaltha had left the house to visit the library, and Diadora was off caring for Theano, who lay at death's threshold. Skepsis had already ordered his coffin to be constructed, a simple box of acacia wood. Earlier, while watering the animals, I'd heard the insistent hammering in the woodworking shop. Eager to show Diadora and Yaltha my collection of codices, I hurried to complete one last task before they returned. I filled the palette with ink and inscribed a title onto the empty page in each book, blowing the ink gently to dry it. The Matriarchs, The Tales of Terror, Phasaelis and Herod Antipas, My Life in Nazareth, Lamentations for Susanna, Jesus, Beloved, Yaltha of Alexandria, Chaya, Lost Daughter, The Ways of the Therapeuti, Thunder, Perfect Mind. Remembering Anhejuana, who signed her name to her writing, I reopened the books and signed mine. Anna. Not Anna, daughter of Matthias, or Anna, wife of Jesus. Just Anna. There was only one codex I didn't sign. When I lifted my pen to Thunder, Perfect Mind, my hand would not move. The words in the book had come from me, but also from beyond me. I closed the leather cover. Awe took hold of me as I arranged the books inside the wall niche, then placed my incantation bowl on top. As I stepped back and took them in, Yaltha entered the room. Pamphile was at her side. 26. My eyes flashed to the goatskin pouch in Pamphile's hand. She held it out to me without a word, her face tense. I took the pouch and fumbled with the knot on the leather tie, my fingers fat as cucumbers. Prying open the drawstring, I peered inside at a scrolled parchment. I wanted to snatch it out and read it that moment, but I loosely retied the pouch. Yaltha looked at me, understanding, it seemed, that I wished to be alone when I read it, away even from her. A courier arrived with it 3 days ago, Pamphile said. I hired a wagon with a donkey as soon as I could. Apian thinks I'm visiting my family in Dionysius. I led him to believe my father had fallen ill. Thank you, Pamphile, you have done well. It's Lavi you should thank, she replied, her face hardening. He's the one who insisted I remain at Haran's all these months and wait for your letter. If it had been left to me, I would have departed there long ago. I think my husband is more loyal to you than to me. I didn't know how to respond to this. I thought she might be right. Is Lavi well? I asked, hoping to divert her. He's happy with his work at the library. His superiors heap praise on him. I go to him whenever I can. He rents a small apartment now. Every moment the letter remained unopened was an agony, but I owed it to her to listen. Did you see a colony of soldiers on the road near the gatehouse? Yaltha asked. Yes, I've seen these same kind of soldiers in Haran's house. One comes each week to see him. Do you know what they speak about? I asked. She glared at me. Do you expect me to listen at the door? I wish you to do nothing that puts you in danger. You should be prepared when you pass back by the soldiers, Yaltha said. There's no danger to you, but they inspect everyone going east, searching for me and Anna. You'll be stopped. If asked, say you have no knowledge of us, that you came to sell papyrus. Sell papyrus, she repeated,
then glowered at me again. I didn't know I would have to tell more lies for you. Only one more, and only if asked, I said.
I wish this to be over, she said. Now that your letter has come, I only want to leave Haran's employ and go live with my husband.
I tightened my fingers on the letter's pouch. Be patient, Anna, I told myself. You have waited so long. What are a few more minutes?
What news do you have of Haran? Yaltha asked her.
The morning after you left, his shouting could be heard through the house. He searched your rooms in a rage, looking for some sign of where you'd gone. The man ripped bed covers and shattered water pots. Who do you think was charged to clean it up? Me, of course. He plundered the scriptorium as well. I found scrolls across the floor, spilled ink, a broken chair.
Did he suspect you of aiding us? I asked.
He was content to lay the blame on Lavi, but not before he interrogated me and the rest of the servants. Even Thaddeus wasn't spared.
She balled her fists and mimicked Haran. How did they manage to flee? Did they turn into smoke and float under the locked door? Did they fly out the window? Which of you unlocked the door?
He threatened to have us flogged. It is only through Apion's intervention that we were spared. It was plain how much she'd suffered under Haran's roof, separated from Lavi. I'm sorry, I said. You've been a brave and true friend. I pulled the bench toward her. Here, rest. I'll return shortly. Yaltha will bring you food and water. You will stay the night with us. I walked self-consciously from the house, past the assembly hall, the woodworking shop, the clusters of houses, the animal shed, forcing myself not to break into a run. As I passed the eucalyptus tree, I quickened my pace, then took flight up the escarpment toward the cliffs. Finding a boulder midway up, I sat with my back against it, letting the strength of it hold me. My heart was in an uproar. I took a breath, opened the pouch, and pulled out the parchment. Dearest sister, I trust you received my earlier letter explaining why it was not safe for you to return. My mouth parted. Judas had written before. Why had I not received it? The danger to you in Galilee has not fully passed, though it has lessened. Antipas is fully consumed by his lust to be named king of the Jews by Rome. Last week we came into Judea on our way to Jerusalem, where we will remain through Passover. Antipas has no rule here. Come to us with all haste. Sail with Lavi to Joppa and make your way to Bethany, where we lodge at the home of Lazarus, Mary, and Martha. The kingdom is close at hand. Vast throngs of people in Galilee and Judea now hail Jesus as the Messiah. He believes the fullness of time is upon us, and he wishes you by his side. He compelled me to tell you that he is safe. I, though, must warn of dangers. The people are emboldened by the appearance of a Messiah, and there is much talk of revolution. Jesus teaches each day in the temple, and the Jewish authorities set spies upon us the moment we enter the gates. If there is unrest, the temple guard will most certainly arrest him. Jesus continues to believe God's kingdom can come without swords, but I am both a cynic and a zealot. I only know we cannot let this moment pass. If it is necessary, I will do what I must this Passover to ensure the masses rise up and overthrow the Romans at last, the sacrifice of one for many. As I write, I sit in Lazarus's courtyard where your friend Tabitha is playing the lyre, filling the air with the sweetest of music. Jesus has gone to the Mount of Olives to pray. He has missed you, Anna. He bids me give you his love. We await you. Your brother, Judas. 10th day of Shavuot. Judas's words slammed into me. I will do what I must this Passover, the sacrifice of one for many. What did he mean? What was he trying to tell me? I began to breathe very fast, like I'd run a great distance. My head churned with confusion. I turned the parchment over, wishing he might have explained himself on the back, but it was devoid of words. I reread the letter. This time different pieces of it whirled up, broken off words. He wishes you by his side. He bids me give you his love. He has missed you. How had I endured these 2 years without him? I pressed the letter to my breast and held it there. I tried to calculate time. Judas had written the letter early this past winter, 7 weeks ago. Passover in Jerusalem was 14 days away. I stuffed the parchment into the pouch and scrambled to my feet. I must get to Jerusalem, and quickly. 27. Yaltha stood alone in the courtyard. I thrust the letter into her hand, not asking Pamphile's whereabouts. As she read, I watched her face, noticing the flare of surprise toward the end. "Finally, you'll go to your husband," she said. I waited for her to say more, but that was all. I must find a way to leave in the morning. Would she not mention Judas's strange message about ensuring the masses rise up? Behind her, the light was sinking, golden brown scintillas drifting far below over the lake. "What does my brother mean by the sacrifice of one for many?" I asked. "What is he saying?" I watched her step beneath the branches of the tamarisk tree and become pensive. Her need to deliberate filled me with unease. "I think I already know what he means," I said quietly. I'd known before I'd finished the letter, but I couldn't bear to acknowledge it right then. It had seemed impossible that my brother would go so far, but as I stood with Yaltha beneath the tree, I pictured the child whose father was murdered by the Romans and whose mother was sold into slavery, the boy who swore to avenge them, and I knew, yes, he would go that far. "Judas," Yaltha hissed. From the corner of my eye, I saw a tiny green lizard dart up the stone wall. "Yes, of course you know what he means. You know him better than anyone. Please say it. I cannot." We sat on the bench and she placed her hand at my back. "Judas means to have his revolution, Anna. If Jesus doesn't bring it about peaceably, Judas means to ignite it by force. The surest way to incite the masses is for the Romans to execute their Messiah." "He will deliver Jesus to the Romans," I whispered. Saying the words, I felt like I was falling off the edge of the world. During the time we'd been in Egypt, I'd stored away 1,000 tears, and I let them loose now. Yaltha pulled my head to her shoulder and let me sob my fear, helplessness, and fury. The deluge went on for several minutes, and in the aftermath I experienced a great calm. I said, "Why would Judas be so brazen as to reveal his intention to me?" "That is hard to know. Confessing to you may have been a way of alleviating his guilt. When it comes to overthrowing the Romans, Judas feels no guilt. He may have been trying to find the boldness to go through with it, like throwing your money bag over a wall to ensure you'll climb over." She was doing her best to humor my need to understand at least some part of Judas's warped design, but I realized how futile it was. "I'll never understand any of this," I said. "And right now it doesn't matter. It only matters that I get to Jerusalem." I stood and peered over the wall toward the road, another anxiety taking over, Haran and his soldiers. At that same moment, Skepsis and Diodora entered the courtyard. "Theano has died," Skepsis announced. "Diodora and I have just finished preparing his body. Has something happened?" Diodora interrupted, noticing my reddened eyes, or perhaps it was the taut, menacing air. I picked up Judas's letter and read it to them, then tried my best to elucidate Judas's plan. Diodora, who knew nothing of Jewish messiahs and radical zealots, seemed utterly mystified. She enfolded me in her arms. "I'm happy you will see your husband, but I am sad you will leave us." She turned to her mother. "Will you go too?" she asked in an unassuming way, but her face betrayed her fear. "I'll remain here," Yaltha said, looking past Diodora to me. "Having found Diodora, I cannot leave her again. I'm getting too old to make the journey anyway, and Egypt is my home. I'm content here among the Therapeuti. It will grieve me to be separated from you, Anna, but I cannot leave." I felt a crumbling inside, but I refused to let my disappointment show. I said, "I understand, Aunt. Your decision is as it should be." Shadows had begun to darken the edges of the courtyard, and Diodora went into the house for a lamp, though I had the feeling she left out of kindness, not wanting me to see her joy. She returned with a look of confusion on her face. "The woman sleeping inside, she's the servant in Haran's house who showed me to your quarters." "Yes, Pamphile," Yaltha said. "She delivered the letter from Judas. She was weary. I helped her with some chamomile." We settled around the glowing circle of lamplight, and I posed the question that loomed over everything. How will I get past the soldiers? I looked at their faces. I had no answer. They stared back. They had no answer either. "Is there no way to leave here except by the road where the soldiers stand guard?" Diodora asked. "Is there a footpath that skirts around them?" Skepsis shook her head. We are hemmed in by the cliffs. The road is our only way of leaving, and the soldiers are positioned too close to the gatehouse to miss anyone who comes and goes from here. Could you disguise yourself somehow? Diadora asked. As an old woman? You could cover your head and use a crutch.
I doubt they'd be fooled by that, said Yaltha. It's far too risky, but...
I prodded her.
What is it? We must consider everything.
Pamphile will leave tomorrow. The wagon she arrived in is large enough for you to hide in the back. She glanced at Skepsis, shrugging uncertainly. What if we concealed her beneath the sacks that store the vegetable seed?
The soldiers always search the carts that bring flour and salt, Skepsis said. They would search Pamphile's wagon, too.
They grew quiet. A thin, gray hopelessness crept into the air. I didn't want them to give up. It was true I no longer believed in the god of rescue, only the god of presence, but I believed in Sophia, who whispered bravery and wisdom in my ear day and night, if I would only listen, and I tried now to do that, to listen. What I heard was hammering, faint but so clear I thought for a moment Pamphile had wakened and was rapping on the door from inside the house. The realization that the sound resounding in my head was actually a memory startled me. I knew instantly what that memory was. I'd heard it that morning while watering the animals. It was the hammering from the woodworking shop as Theano's coffin was being built. The sound formed into an idea. I said, "There is one way for me to leave here safely, and that's inside Theano's coffin." They sat there with blank faces. I would not be inside the coffin long, only until Pamphile drives the cart an ample distance past the soldiers. I will take any risk to reach Jesus, but this one puts me in the least peril. The soldiers would never think to open the coffin.
That is true, Diadora said. Violating the dead is a serious offense. One can be put to death for opening a tomb.
And for Jews, a corpse is unclean, I added.
I tried, but was unable to read Yaltha's expression. She must have thought my idea was elaborately strange.
I believe it is the very boldness of the notion that will cause it to work, I continued. Do you think differently, Aunt?
She said, I think the idea of you riding away in Theano's coffin is absurd, but it's also ingenious, Little Thunder. My eyes rounded. No one had ever called me Little Thunder but Jesus. I received the name from her like a charge. Go. Be boiling clouds and lightning spears and sky-splitting roars.
Now, she said, let's imagine how you will accomplish this insane act. All of us turned pointedly to Skepsis, who was studying the trails of blue on the back of her hands. None of this could be done without her. I was proposing we confiscate Theano's coffin, requiring another one to be swiftly constructed for him. Furthermore, if Skepsis entered into the deception, she would deceive the whole community.
Lucian is our biggest concern, she said. If he suspects it's not Theano in the coffin, he'll convey his suspicions to the soldiers, and Anna is certain to be discovered.
She fell quiet, mulling further. When she lifted her face, her eyes were doing their owlish dance. Theano's wish was to be buried here on our grounds, but I'll put out word that he wished to be buried in his family's tomb in Alexandria. This is quite typical for our wealthier members. Of course, Theano's family is not rich, but they would have enough for a mud-brick tomb, I'm sure. I'll tell everyone that the servant who delivered the letter, what was her name?
Pamphile, I answered, amazed at the intricacies she was working out.
Until this moment, Lucian had not received a thought from me. I'll explain that Pamphile was sent from Theano's family to bring his body to Alexandria. This should resolve the matter.
It should also put an end to the outpost of soldiers at our gate, said Yaltha. If Anna is no longer here, there will be no need for the soldiers.
What about you? Said Diadora, looking at Yaltha.
Haran would still wish to arrest you.
Skepsis lifted a finger. I knew this to be a good sign.
When Anna is well away, I'll address the community, stating she has returned to her husband in Galilee, and Yaltha has taken the vows to remain part of the therapeuty for life. It will not take Lucian long to put this news in Haran's ear. I think Haran will be relieved to have a legitimate reason to put an end to all this. My brother will at least be thrilled to no longer pay the soldiers from his own money bags. The only reason he has kept the outpost going this long is so not to be perceived as backing down.
I admired the scheme that had just come into being and feared in equal measure that it would fail. Diadora said, What will we do with poor Theano during all of this? That will be easy. We'll keep him concealed in his house until Anna is gone, Skepsis said. Then we three, along with Gaius, our carpenter, will give him a proper burial without Lucian's knowledge. It sounded anything but easy. And Gaius is trustworthy? Yaltha asked. Gaius? Most certainly. When I leave here, I'll ask him to begin work this very night on a second coffin and to create two small holes in one of them for breathing. That detail sent a shudder through me. I imagined the tight, airless space and wondered for the first time if I could go through with this. The community has been notified to gather at the first hour tomorrow to say the prayers for the dead for Theano. Skepsis said, You should be among us, Anna. When will she be placed in the coffin? Diadora asked. Her eyes were wide and worried, and I thought she was feeling the tight, airless space, too. After the prayers, Anna, you slip away to the woodworking shop, where Gaius will lightly nail you inside the coffin. 4 short nails, no more. I'll instruct him to place an awl in the wagon for Pamphile, but also one inside the coffin so you may pry the lid yourself. Then he and his helper will load you onto the wagon. Meanwhile, I will keep Lucian occupied. Yaltha held out her knotty hands to me, and I took them. I'll go with Anna to the woodworking shop to make certain everything is done as prescribed, she said. I'll go too, Diadora said. We want no danger to come to you, sister. A noise came from within the house, then footsteps. Pamphile called. Yaltha? Anna? I tell you, I said. The greatest danger to me is Pamphile refusing to open the lid. Yaltha laughed. She was the only one to understand my uneasy jest. 28. At first, Pamphile seemed agreeable to our well-laid plan, but when I told her Lavi must travel with me to Judea, she rolled out her lower lip and folded her arms over her chest. Then I will not do it. Behind me, I heard Yaltha, Skepsis, and Diadora sigh with one accord. For the past half hour, the three of them had been like a small Greek chorus, offering refrains and harmonious sighs, while I tried my best to convince Pamphile to join our subterfuge. We were crowded into the holy room, which had grown thick with the smell of palm oil from the lamps. Yaltha had left the door open to the courtyard, but the little room was stifling. A trickle of sweat darted between my breasts. Please, Pamphile, I pleaded. My husband's life may depend upon your answer. I must get to Jerusalem and stop my brother. Yes, so you said. She enjoys this, I thought, this power she holds. It's too dangerous for me to travel alone, I said, feeling the words like stones in my mouth. Without Lavi, I won't be able to go. Then you must find someone else, she said. There is no one else. This needs to be settled quickly, Skepsis interjected. If you are leaving here by coffin, I must alert Gaius right away, and Pamphile must come with me and stay at my house for the night. Otherwise, some will wonder why a servant from Theano's family would lodge with you. Yes, please take her. I tried again. If you're worried Lavi may not return to Alexandria, I assure you I have enough money to purchase his passage back. I'll show you, if you like. I don't care to see your money. I trust that you would send him back. Then what is it? Diadora asked. Pamphile's eyes shrank. I have already lived apart from my husband for 5 months because of you. I don't intend to do so any longer. I did not know how to get through to her. She was lonely for her husband. How could I blame her? I glanced helplessly at Yaltha, who stepped past me, closer to Pamphile, in order to make some last effort. I remember thinking, we've come to the split in the river. I felt, whether or not it was true, that my life would be decided now. It would rush one way or go the other. Yaltha spoke with uncommon gentleness. Did you know that Anna has been apart from her own husband for 2 years? I saw it then, a softening in Pamphile's face. I'm sorry for the months you were separated from Lavi, I told her. I know the pain of it. I know what it's like to lie in bed and ache for your husband, to wake up and feel his absence. Even as I said these things, I felt Jesus moving around the edges of my vision like a lost dream. She said, If Lavi left, how long would he be gone? A smidgen of hope. 3 weeks, perhaps, no more. And what will become of his position at the library? Will they receive him back?
I correspond with the scholar there, said Skepsis. She was thumping her finger impatiently on the table. I'll make certain your husband is given leave.
Pamphile dropped her arms to her sides.
Let it be as you wish, she said.
I could not sleep that night, even with Yaltha's chamomile. My thoughts spun. It was the deep of night, but I rose from my mat and stole past Diodora and Yaltha, who were making quiet, slumbering sounds. Standing in the darkened holy room, I felt the finality of being here. My large woolen travel pouch sat on the table, stuffed full. Diodora and Yaltha had watched in silence as I'd packed it. It contained the pouch that held my red thread, Judas's letter, the mummy portrait, money, two tunics, a cloak, and undergarments. I'd left the new black and red Alexandrian dress for Diodora. I would have no use for it anymore. I could hardly bear to look at the niche where my 10 codices were stacked in a beautiful leaning tower with my incantation bowl perched on top. It wasn't possible to take them with me. I might have carried a second bag and squeezed in 5 codices, maybe 6, but something inexplicable inside me wished the books to remain altogether. I wanted them here among the Therapeuti, where they might be read and preserved, and perhaps cherished. I moved about the room, telling everything goodbye. Yaltha's voice came from the doorway. I will safeguard your words until you return. I turned to her. I will likely never return, Aunt. You know that. She nodded, accepting what I'd said without questioning it. After I leave, place my writings in the library with the other manuscripts, I said. I'm ready now for others to read them. She came and stood close to me. Do you remember the day in Sepphoris when you opened your cedar chest and showed me your writings for the first time? I've not forgotten it, nor will I ever forget it, I said. You were something to be reckoned with. 14 years old and full of rebellion and longings, you were the most stubborn, determined, ambitious child I'd ever seen. When I saw what was inside your cedar chest, I knew. She smiled. Knew what? That there was also largeness in you. I knew you possessed a generosity of abilities that comes only rarely into the world. You knew it, too, for you wrote of it in your bowl. But we all have some largeness in us, don't we, Anna? What are you saying, Aunt? What most sets you apart is the spirit in you that rebels and persists. It isn't the largeness in you that matters most. It's your passion to bring it forth. I gazed at her but could not speak. I went down on my knees, I don't know why, except I felt overcome by what she'd said. She placed her hand on my head. She said, "My own largeness has been to bless yours." 29. The coffin lay on the floor in the middle of the woodworking shop, smelling of fresh wood. Yaltha, Diodora, and I gathered beside it and stared somberly into the empty cavity.
Don't think of it as a coffin, Diodora advised.
We mustn't delay, Gaius said. Now that the prayers for Theano are over, members will be lining the path, wanting to proceed behind the wagon as far as the gatehouse. We can't risk one of them wandering nearby and finding you. Quickly, now.
He gripped my elbow as I stepped into the coffin. I stood there a moment before sitting, unable to think of the wooden box as anything other than what it was. I told myself just not to think at all. Diodora bent and kissed my cheeks, then Yaltha. As my aunt hovered over me, I tried to memorize her face. Gaius placed the travel pouch at my feet and the awl in my hand. Hold on to it. I lay back and looked up into the bright room. The lid slid over me. Then darkness. The coffin juddered as Gaius hammered in 4 nails, causing my head to knock against the bottom. In the stillness that followed, I became aware of 2 thin beams of light. They reminded me of the fine strands of a spider's web lit with sunlight and dew. I turned my head and found the source, a tiny perforation on each side, my breathing holes. The coffin was lifted with a jerk. Unprepared for it, I let out a small cry.
You'll have to stay quieter than that, Gaius said, his voice sounding far away. As they carried me outside, I braced for another jolt, but the coffin slid smoothly into the wagon. I couldn't tell when Pamphile climbed in,
Maybe she was there already. But I heard the donkey bray and felt the lurch of the cart as we started down the hill. I closed my eyes so as not to see the coffin's lid, which was a hand's breadth from my nose. I listened instead to the rumble of the wagon, then to the muffled singing that began to follow us. Don't think. Don't think. It will be over soon. When we made a sharp turn north, the singing receded into the distance, and I knew we'd passed the gatehouse and turned onto the road. Moments later, one of the soldiers shouted, "Halt!" and the wheels on the cart ground to a stop. The beat of my heart came so hard, I imagined the sound of it streaming out through the air holes. I was afraid to breathe. The soldier addressed Pamphile. "We were told a man among the Therapeuti died. Where are you taking him?" It was difficult to hear her answer. "To his family in Alexandria, I believed," she said. Relief surged through me. I thought we would be waved on now, but the cart didn't move. The soldiers' voices drew closer, seeming to move to the back of the cart. A thread of panic began to unravel in me. My eyes flew open, met by the lid of the coffin. I drew a pant and shut them again. "Don't move. Don't think." We lingered an interminable time for reasons I could not deduce. Then I heard one of them say, "There's nothing back here but the coffin." Suddenly the wagon staggered forward. We plodded on and on, jostling along the rutted road for much longer than seemed necessary. Pamphile had been instructed to stop the cart when the soldiers were out of sight, preferably along a lonely stretch, and free me. The heat inside the coffin had concentrated. I took the awl and knocked against the side of the coffin. I didn't know whether people might be about, but I no longer cared. I forced the end of the awl beneath the lid and attempted to pry it upward, but there was not enough room inside for my arms to lift up or press down. I rapped harder on the side. "Pamphile!" I screamed. "Stop now and free me!" The wagon traveled on for some minutes before she brought it to a stop. I heard the split of wood as she pushed her awl under the lid and rested the coffin open. There was a dazzling rush of light. Lavi and I set sail for Judea on the 5th of Nisan. Jerusalem, Bethany, 30 CE. 1. As Lavi and I arrived outside Jerusalem, the slopes of the Kidron Valley came into view, lit with 1,000 pilgrim campfires. Funnels of pale smoke drifted across the night sky, thick with the smell of roasted lamb. It was the 13th of Nisan, Passover. I had hoped to reach the home of Lazarus, Mary, and Martha before nightfall, early enough to eat the festival meal with Jesus. I sighed. The meal would be over by now. Lavi and I had suffered one excruciating delay after another. First, the sea winds deserted us, slowing our ship's arrival. Then, on foot from Joppa, we had difficulty finding food due to the crowds, forcing us to detour to out-of-the-way villages to buy bread and cheese. We were obstructed for hours in Lud by Roman soldiers attempting to control the clogged road to Jerusalem. Throughout, I'd practiced in my head what I would say to Judas, reassuring myself he would listen. I was his little sister. He loved me. He'd tried to rescue me from Nathaniel. He'd taken my message to Phasaelus against his own wishes. He would listen and then abandon this madness that would have him betray Jesus. As I gazed at the hillside, the urgency I felt inside made it difficult to breathe. Lavi said, "Do you need to rest?" We'd been walking since daybreak. "My husband and my brother are just beyond this valley," I said. "I will rest once I see them." We walked the last stretch to Bethany in silence. Had I not been so weary, my feet might have broken into a run. "The lamps in the courtyard are still burning," Lavi said as we reached the house of Jesus' friends, and now my friends, too. He pounded on the gate, calling out that Anna, wife of Jesus, had arrived. I expected to see Jesus hurrying to let us in, but Lazarus came. He looked well, not nearly so yellow and pallid as when I'd seen him before. He greeted me with a kiss. "Come, both of you." "Where is Jesus?" I said. His feet slowed, but he walked on into the courtyard as if he hadn't heard. "Mary, Martha," he called. "Look who's here."
The sisters rushed from the house, throwing their arms open. They seemed shorter, their faces rounder. They greeted Lavi with the same warmth they'd once bestowed on Tabitha. Thinking of her, I looked about, but she, too, was nowhere to be seen. I did notice a stack of sleeping mats piled beside the outer wall. Folded on top of them was a worn flaxen cloak.
"You and Lavi must be famished," Martha said. "I'll bring what's left of the Passover meal."
As she hurried off, I went and picked up the cloak. It bore my poor, uneven weaving. I held the garment to my face. It was filled with his scent.
"This belongs to Jesus," I said to Mary.
She smiled in that serene way of hers.
"It's his, yes."
"And this as well," said Lavi, holding up a staff made of olive wood, the one Jesus had carved while sitting beneath the tree in the compound in Nazareth. I took it, wrapping my fingers around the wood, feeling the smooth, polished place his hand had worn. "Jesus and his disciples have been staying with us for some time," Mary said, nodding at the mound of bed mats. "They spend their days in the city and return in the evening to sleep in the courtyard. This past week, each time Jesus came through the gate, he would ask, 'Has Anna come?'"
"You seemed very much on his mind." She smiled at me. I bit hard into my lip.
"Where is he?" I asked.
"He observed Passover in Jerusalem with his disciples."
"Not here with you?"
"We expected them to share the meal with us, but Jesus changed his mind only this morning, saying he would take Passover alone with his disciples in the city. I admit it did not please Martha. She'd prepared enough for the lot of them, and I can attest they eat a great deal."
She laughed, and it came out all wrong, high-pitched and uneasy.
"Was Judas among them?"
"Your brother, yes. He hardly left Jesus' side, except..."
I waited, but she did not continue.
"Except?"
"It's nothing. It's just that yesterday, when Jesus and the others returned from the city, Judas was not with them. I heard Jesus ask Peter and John if they knew his whereabouts. It was quite late when he finally appeared, and even then he kept to himself. He ate alone over there in the corner." She pointed across the courtyard. "I thought he didn't feel well."
I doubted this odd behavior of Judas's was nothing, as she'd suggested, though I couldn't have said what it meant. I was still clutching Jesus' staff and his cloak, gripping them so tightly I became aware of an ache in my fingers. Relinquishing the items onto a bench, I walked to the gap in the courtyard wall and looked west toward Jerusalem. Shouldn't Jesus have returned by now? Mary came and stood beside me. "It's his custom to pray on the Mount of Olives each evening, but even so, he's long overdue." Her face was shadowed, but I saw something there, something more than dismay at his lateness. I saw dread.
"Anna?"
The voice came from across the courtyard, one I'd not heard in 7 years.
"Tabitha!"
I cried, running toward her even as she ran to me. We clung to each other for a long while, her ear pushed against my cheek. We spoke no words but swayed together, a kind of dance. I closed my eyes, remembering the girls who had danced blind.
"I cannot believe you are here," she said. "You must never go away again."
The words came out slow, measured, thick-tongued, as if they were too cumbersome for her mouth, but every syllable was there.
"You speak with clarity," I said.
"I've had many years to practice. The tongue is an adaptable creature. It finds a way." I took her hands and kissed them. Martha appeared then, carrying a tray of food, followed by Lazarus with a sloshing pitcher of wine. While Lavi and I cleansed our hands, Mary bid Tabitha to fetch her lyre and play for us.
"You have never heard such music," she told me.
I wanted to hear Tabitha play, I truly did, but not right then. Right then I wanted the four of them to tell me about my husband, the things he'd said and done. I wanted to know about the danger he was in that no one would speak of. I watched Tabitha dash away and said nothing. Mary was right about one thing. I'd never heard such music. Quick, daring, even funny, the song was about a woman who cut off her torturer's beard as he slept, causing him to lose his powers. Tabitha danced as she strummed, twirling about the courtyard, graceful as ever,
and I thought how much she would love the Therapeutes' 49th day rituals, all that endless music and dancing. When she finished, I set down the nugget of bread I was about to dip in my wine cup and embraced her yet again. She was breathless, her face flushed bright. Only yesterday, I played my lyre as your husband and his disciples ate. I will not forget what Jesus said to me when I finished my song. He said, "Each of us must find a way to love the world. You have found yours. He's very kind, your husband." I smiled. "He's also very insightful. You have indeed found yours. The most wounded thing in us always finds a way," I thought. I could see in her eyes there was more she wished to confide. "Tabitha," I whispered, "what is it?" "For most of the years I've been here, I've earned coins by weaving widows' garments, a portion of which I give to Martha for my keep. With the rest of it, I bought a jar of spikenard." I wrinkled my forehead, wondering why she would buy such an expensive perfume, then remembered how we'd once dabbed it on each other's foreheads and made a covenant of friendship. "The scent held pleasant memories for me," she said. "Yesterday, though, after Jesus spoke so kindly to me, I fetched it and anointed his feet. I wanted to thank him for what he'd said to me, and the spikenard was all I had." She glanced behind her at the others, who couldn't help but hear her. She lowered her voice. "What I did angered your brother. He chastised me, saying I should have sold the ointment and given the money to the poor." "Judas, what happened to you?" "Did Jesus fault him?" I asked, knowing the answer. "He told Judas to leave me alone, that I'd done a beautiful thing. He said it sharply, and Judas departed in a temper. Oh, Anna, I fear I've caused a rift between them." I covered her hands with mine. The rift was already there. It had, I realized, always been there, buried deep within their differing visions of how to establish God's kingdom. I returned to my plate, but I could no longer eat. I looked at Mary, Lazarus, and Martha. "Will you tell me now what troubles you? I know Jesus is in danger. Judas wrote of it in his letter. Tell me what you know." Lazarus shifted on the bench between his two sisters. He said, "Jesus has gained much fame, Anna. People believe him to be the Messiah, King of the Jews." "I heard of this while I was in Alexandria," I said, almost relieved that he'd said nothing new. "It concerned me as well. Herod Antipas has spent his life trying to become King of the Jews. If word of this reaches him, he'll retaliate." Silence, discomfiture. None of them looked at me. "What is it?" I demanded. Mary nudged her brother. "Tell her. We should hold nothing back." Laying down the lyre, Tabitha caught one of the strings on her finger, the sound like a small whimper. I motioned her to the seat beside me, and we sat pressed together. "Antipas already knows the people call Jesus King of the Jews," Lazarus said. "There's not a soul in Jerusalem who hasn't heard of it, including the Romans. But the governor, Pilate, is an even greater threat than Antipas. He is known for his brutality. He will crush any threat to peace within the city." I shivered, and not from the cold seeping into the night air. "Last Sunday, Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey," he said.
There's a prophecy that the Messiah King will come into Jerusalem humbly, sitting on an ass. I knew the prophecy. We all knew the prophecy. That Jesus had done such a thing rendered me speechless. It was a blatant acceptance of the role. But why did this shock me? I thought of the epiphany he'd had when he was baptized, the revelation that he must act, how he'd gone off with John the Immerser. The crowds followed after him, Lazarus was saying. They were shouting, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. We were there, Mary added. The people were carried away with jubilation, believing they would soon be delivered from the Romans and that God's kingdom would be ushered in. You should have seen them, Anna. They broke branches off the trees and strew them in his path. We walked behind him with his disciples and joined in ourselves. If I'd been there, would I have tried to stop him or blessed the fierce need that drove him? I didn't know. I honestly didn't know. Lazarus walked to the wall gap, just as I'd done a short while before, and stared across the valley toward the city, as if trying to divine where in the web of narrow, twisting, fevered streets his old friend was. We watched him, his back to us, hands clasped behind him, the relentless way he rubbed his fingers. Jesus has proclaimed that he is a Messiah, he said, turning toward us. He did it believing God will act, but it wasn't only a religious statement. It was a political one. That's what worries me most, Anna. Pilate knows the Jewish Messiah is meant to overthrow Rome. He will take it seriously. All this time Martha had said nothing, but I saw her sit straighter on the bench and draw a breath. She said, There is one more thing, Anna. The day after Jesus announced himself on the donkey, he returned to Jerusalem and... Tell her, Mary. Mary gave her a rueful look. Yes, he returned to the city and started a commotion in the temple. It was more than a commotion, Martha said. It was a riot. Mary sent her another look of exasperation. What do you mean a riot? I asked. This time we were not there, Mary said, but the disciples said he became angry over the corruption of the money changers and the men who sell the animals for sacrifice. Martha broke in. He upended their tables, scattering coins, and kicked over the seats of the pigeon sellers. He shouted that they'd turned the temple into a den of thieves. People scrambled to pluck up the coins. The temple guard was summoned. He wasn't harmed, was he? No, said Mary. Surprisingly, the temple authorities didn't apprehend him. Yes, but Caiaphas, the high priest, is set against him now, Lazarus said. I don't like to admit it, but Jesus is very much in danger. Tabitha leaned into me. We sat for several moments before I could ask the question. Do you think they will arrest him? It's hard to say, Lazarus answered. The mood in the city is volatile. Pilate and Caiaphas want nothing more than to be rid of him. Jesus could easily start a revolt. I cannot believe that's his wish, I said. My husband was a resistor to Rome, but not a violent one. He was not like my brother. I wondered about his intention, Lazarus said. He seemed to purposely provoke the authorities. But that same night, he stood right here where I'm standing now and told his disciples that whatever happened, they would not take up the sword. Judas challenged him, saying, How do you expect to free us from Rome without a fight? You speak of love. How will that rid us of Rome? I know he's your brother, Anna, but he was angry, almost hostile. Judas is a zealot, I said. The Romans murdered his father and sent his mother into slavery. His whole life has been about seeking vengeance. Even as I said this, I marveled that I made excuses for him. He meant to overthrow the Romans, even if he had to hand Jesus over to spark a revolution. There would never be enough excuses for that. Fury surged into my chest. I said, How did Jesus answer him? He did so sternly. He said, I've spoken, Judas. That silenced him. For a moment, I considered pulling Judas's letter from my travel pouch and reading it to them, but it would do nothing but alarm them more. Lazarus rested his hand on Martha's shoulder. He said, This morning before Jesus left for Jerusalem, I implored him to spend Passover in a quiet fashion and to keep hidden. He agreed. If the authorities seek to arrest him, they will have to find him first.
They would have no trouble finding him if Judas intervened to help them. The thought lifted me to my feet. Should we not go and find him ourselves?
Go to Jerusalem, now, said Martha.
Mary said he sometimes prays in the Garden of Gethsemane, I said. We might find him there.
It's almost the second watch of the night, she argued.
Lavi had been slumped against the wall, nearly invisible in the shadows of the house, but he stepped forward now.
I will go with you.
It's foolish to venture into the valley at this hour, Lazarus said. It seems Jesus has decided to spend the night on the hillside. He'll return in the morning.
Mary took my arm. Come, you're weary. Let's get you to bed. Martha prepared you a fresh mat in Tabitha's room.
I'll leave at daybreak, I said, sending Lavi a grateful smile, then let myself be led away, stopping to retrieve Jesus's cloak. I would sleep in the folds of it.
2.
I woke late, well past dawn. I felt for Jesus's cloak beside me on the mat, then sat up and slipped it over my tunic. Moving across the room, I glanced at Tabitha, trying not to wake her. I bent over the basin and splashed a palmful of water across my face, then delved through my few belongings until I found the little pouch with the red thread. I wrapped it about my left wrist, laboring to knot it with my other hand. Lavi was waiting for me in the courtyard. If he wondered at my wearing Jesus's mantle, he didn't say so, nor did he mention the hour. He handed me a piece of bread and a hunk of cheese, which I ate hungrily.
How will we find him? Lavi whispered.
We'll begin at the Garden of Gethsemane. Perhaps he slept there. Do you know where this garden is?
It's at the foot of the Mount of Olives. Last night Tabitha told me of a path that leads there from the village.
I must have looked racked with worry, for he gave me a searching look. Are you all right, sister?
Sister.
The word caused me to think of Judas. I didn't know how to go on being sister to him. I wanted to answer Lavi that I was well, and he shouldn't worry, but I sensed there was some great portending darkness out there.
Brother, I said, my voice cracking a little.
I stood and walked to the gate.
We will find him, Lavi said.
Yes, we will find him.
As we descended the slope, the sun climbed into thick clouds. Everywhere pilgrims were waking beneath the olive trees, the whole hillside seeming to undulate. We walked rapidly, quietly. The hymn I'd written to Sophia began to sing in my ears.
I was sent out from power. Be careful, do not ignore me. I am she who exists in all fears and in trembling boldness.
In the garden I dashed through the trees, calling Jesus's name. No one answered. He did not step out of the gnarling shadows and open his arms, saying, Anna, you've come back. We wandered through every part of the garden.
He's not here, Lavi said.
I came to a standstill, the frantic feeling still going in my chest. I'd been so sure I'd find him here. All night, as I'd wandered in and out of sleep, my mind had pulsed with images of this garden at the foot of the Kidron.
Where is he?
In the distance, I could see the temple protruding beyond the city wall, casting its white dazzle in the air, and next to it, the towers of Antonia, the Roman fortress. Lavi followed my gaze. We should go and search in the city, he said. I was trying to imagine where in the vast maze of Jerusalem he could be, the temple courts, the pool of Bethesda, when I heard someone moaning. The sound was deep and guttural, coming from the trees behind us. I started toward it, but Lavi stepped in my path. Let me go and be certain there's no danger. I waited as he ventured into the grove, disappearing behind an outcrop of rocks.
Anna, come quickly, he called.
Judas sat on the ground, hunched over his knees, rocking back and forth, making a godforsaken sound.
Judas, my Lord and my God, what has happened?
I knelt and placed my hand on his arm. His crying ceased with my touch. He spoke without looking up.
Anna, I saw you from a distance. I didn't mean to draw your attention.
Do not look at me. I cannot bear it.
A sudden coldness formed inside me then. I shot to my feet. Judas, what did you do? When he didn't answer, I shouted, What did you do?
Lavi had kept a tactful distance, but he was beside me now. I didn't take time to explain what was happening, but stooped once more in front of my brother, fighting to drive the fear and outrage from my throat. Tell me, Judas, now.
He looked up, and I saw it in his eyes.
You handed Jesus over to the Romans, didn't you? I'd meant to hurl the accusation, wanting it to strike him like a slap, but the words came out in a whisper, floating into the quietness like a moth or a butterfly, its wings a thing of incomprehension.
Judas squeezed his hand into a fist and struck himself hard in the chest. There was a leather pouch filled with silver coins opened beside him on the ground. He grabbed it and flung the money into the trees. I watched, breathless, as the coins fell to the ground and lay there glinting like the shed scales of some grotesque creature.
I didn't hand him to the Romans.
He was composed, but compelled now to recite every recrimination against himself. The scorpion tail scar beneath his eye rippled up and down with his jaw.
Last night, I, his friend and brother, turned him over to the temple guard, knowing they would hand him to the Romans. I led the guard here where I knew Jesus would be. I kissed his cheek so the soldiers would know who he was. He pointed to a spot in front of him. That's where Jesus stood when I kissed him. Just there.
I looked at the place where he'd pointed. Brown dirt, tiny white rocks, the imprint of sandals.
He kept talking in his tortured, calm voice. I wanted to give the people a reason to revolt. I wanted to help bring God's kingdom. I thought it was what he wanted, too. I believed if I forced his hand, he would see it was the only way, that he'd resist the soldiers and lead the uprising, and if not, that his death would inspire the people to do so themselves.
Violence, uprising, death, ridiculous, meaningless words. But do you know what Jesus said to me when I kissed him? He saw the soldiers coming behind me with their swords drawn, and he said, Judas, would you betray me with a kiss? Anna, you have to believe me. I didn't know until that moment what I'd done, how I'd misled myself. I'm sorry. He dropped his head onto his knees. The moans came again.
Now he was sorry? I wanted to throw myself at him and claw the skin from his face.
Anna, please.
Judas said, I don't expect you to understand what I've done, but I'm asking you to do what I cannot. Forgive me.
Where's my husband? I said. Where did they take him?
He closed his eyes. They took him to Caiaphas's house. I followed them. At dawn, they delivered him to the Western Palace. It's where the Roman governor resides when he's in Jerusalem. The Roman governor, Pilate, the one Lazarus had called brutal. I searched for the sun, hoping to guess the time, but the sky had solidified into a gray murk. Is Jesus still there?
I don't know, he said. I couldn't bear to remain and learn his fate. The last I saw him, he was standing on the porch at the palace before Pilate.
The palace, where is it?
It's in the upper city, near Mariamne's tower.
I bolted, Lavi chasing after me.
Anna! Anna!
Judas called. I didn't answer.
3. We entered Jerusalem through the Golden Gate, crossing the court of the Gentiles and plunging into the tight, twisting streets bloated with Passover pilgrims. I looked west for a glimpse of Mariamne's tower. Smoke from the temple altar hung overhead in a thin, drooping canopy, infused with the revolting smell of burned animal entrails. I could see nothing. We threaded our way through the masses in the upper city with excruciating slowness. Move, move, move. A desperate, anxious feeling battered against my breast.
There, I cried. There's the tower.
It jutted up from the corner of Herod's palace into the stench and haze. We turned a corner, then another, careening into a host of people lining the street and the rooftops above it. I wondered if we'd blundered upon a stoning.
I looked for some poor woman accused of adultery or thievery, crouched alone on the street. I knew the terror of it. But the crowd did not seem stirred to anger. They appeared dazed, grieved, possessed by an unnatural quiet. I didn't know what was happening, nor did I have time to inquire. I pushed through them toward the street, determined to reach the palace and gain news of Jesus. As I reached the edge of the crowd, I heard horse hooves, then a bone-scraping noise as if some heavy object was being dragged over the street stones.
"Make way!"
a voice shouted. Glancing about for Lavi, I spotted him some distance behind me.
"Anna," he called. "Anna, stop!"
It was not possible to stop. He must know this. I stepped into the street. I saw everything then. The Roman centurion on the black horse, the firebird plumes on his helmet, the splash of red they created in the grayness, 4 soldiers on foot, the flap of their capes, the puncturing jabs their spears made overhead as they marched. A man staggered behind them in a filthy, blood-stained tunic, bent beneath the weight of a large, roughly hewn timber. One end of the plank rested on his right shoulder, the other end dragged on the street behind him. I watched for long, stupefied moments as the man labored to hold up the beam. Reaching me, Lavi grabbed my arm and swung me toward him, away from the street. "Don't look," he said. His eyes were like the spear tips. I felt the wind rise, a hollow, whooshing sound. Lavi went on saying words. I no longer heard him. I was remembering the timbers that stood erect on the stark little hill just outside Jerusalem, the hill they called the Place of the Skull. Lavi and I had seen them only yesterday as we'd approached the city after our long trek from Joppa. In the dusk, they'd appeared like a little forest of dead trees amputated at the neck. We knew them to be the upright beams of the crosses on which the Romans crucified their victims, but neither of us had said it. The bone scrape on the street intensified. I turned back to the sad procession. The soldiers are taking the man to the place of the skull. He's carrying the crossbeam. I studied him closer. There was a familiarity about him, something about the shape of his shoulders. He lifted his head, and his dark hair parted to reveal his face. This man was my husband. "Jesus," I said quietly, speaking to myself, to Lavi, to no one. Lavi tugged my arm. "Do not be a witness to this, Anna. Spare yourself." I wrenched free, unable to tear my eyes from Jesus. He wore a cap plaited out of the thorn twigs used to kindle fires. He'd been flogged. His arms and legs were a mass of torn skin and dried blood. A howl formed in my belly and pushed into my mouth. It came without sound, just a violent spasm of pain. Jesus stumbled, and though he was at least 20 arm lengths away from me, I reached out to catch him. He fell hard onto one knee and wavered there as a puddle of blood oozed around it. Then he collapsed, the crossbeam thudding onto his back. I screamed, and this time it split the stones. As I started toward him, Lavi's hand clamped my wrist. "You cannot go to him. If you impede these men, they will not hesitate to kill you as well." I jerked my arm, twisting to free myself. The soldiers were shouting at Jesus to get up, prodding him with the shafts of their spears. "Get up, Jew, get to your feet." He tried, pushing onto his elbow, then dropped back onto his chest. My wrist burned from Lavi's grip. He would not relent. The centurion climbed down from the black horse and kicked the crossbeam off Jesus' back. "Leave him be," he ordered his men. "He can carry it no farther." I hardened my eyes. "Release me now, or I shall never forgive you." Lavi dropped his hand, and I charged into the street past the soldiers, keeping my eye on the centurion, who paced the edge of the crowd with his back to me. I knelt beside Jesus, possessed now by an eerie calm, by a self barely known to me. Everything receded into the distance, the street, the soldiers, the noise, the city walls. The people craning to watch, the whole pageant of horrors abating until there was nothing there but Jesus and me. His eyes were closed. He didn't move or seem to breathe, and I wondered if he was already dead. He would never know I was here, but I was relieved for him. Crucifixion was barbarous. I rolled him gently onto his side and and a breath floated up. Beloved, I said, bending close. He blinked and his gaze found me. Anna? I'm here. I've come back. I'm here. A drop of blood trickled over his brow, pooling in the corner of his eye. I took the sleeve of my cloak, his cloak, and dabbed it. His eyes lingered on the red thread on my arm, the one that was there at the beginning, and would be there at the end. I will not leave you, I said. Don't be afraid, he whispered. Far away, I heard the centurion command a bystander to step forward and carry the crossbeam. Jesus and I didn't have long. In these last minutes, what did he most want to hear? That he'd been seen and heard in this world? That he'd accomplished what he'd set out to do? That he'd loved and been loved? Your goodness will not be forgotten, I told him. Not a single act of your love will be squandered. You've brought God's kingdom as you hoped. You've planted it in our hearts. He smiled, and I saw my face in the dark gold suns of his eyes. Little thunder, he said. I cupped my hands about his face. I said, how I love you. We lingered only a second longer before the centurion returned and jerked me upward. He flung me to the side of the street, where I stumbled into a man who put out his hand to keep me from falling, but I fell nonetheless. As Lavi appeared and helped me up, I looked back at Jesus, who was being roughly hefted to his feet. His eyes lighted on mine before he trudged forward behind the large man chosen to carry the crossbeam. As the procession began again, I noticed that the strap on one of my sandals had broken when I fell. I stooped and removed both shoes. I would go to my husband's execution as he did. Barefoot. 4. I called out in Aramaic, I'm here, beloved. I'm walking behind you. The centurion twisted in his saddle and looked at me, but said nothing. Most of the spectators had hastened ahead of us toward the Geneth gate that led to Golgotha, too impatient to wait on the man who was taking one slow, agonizing step after another. Glancing behind me, I saw that the few who'd remained to walk with him were women. Where were these disciples of his? The fishermen, the men? Were we women the only ones with hearts large enough to hold such anguish? All at once a cluster of women joined me, two on my right, two on my left. One took my hand, squeezing it. I was startled to see she was my mother-in-law. Her face was wet and shattered. She said, Anna. Oh, Anna. Next to her, Mary, the sister of Lazarus, tilted her head at me and sent me a steadying look. At my other side, a woman slid her arm about my waist and gave me a wordless embrace. Salome. I grasped her hand and pulled it to my chest. Beside her was a woman I'd never seen before, with copper hair and flashing eyes, whom I guessed to be the age of my mother when I last saw her. We walked pressed together, shoulder to shoulder. As we left the city gate and the hill of Golgotha came into view, Jesus halted, staring up at the little summit. Beloved, I'm still here, I said. He lurched forward, moving against the swell of wind. My son, I am here also, cried Mary, her voice shaking, the words shredding apart as they left her lips. And your sister walks with you as well, Salome said. It is Mary of Bethany, I too am here. Then the unknown woman called. Jesus, it's Mary of Magdala. As he climbed the slope, toiling to lift his feet, I quickened my pace and drew closer behind him. The day we gathered our daughter's bones, the valley was full of wild lilies. Do you remember? I called out the words loudly enough for him to hear, hoping not to draw the soldier's attention. You told me to consider the lilies, that God takes care of them and will surely then care for us. Consider them now, my love. Consider the lilies. I wished for something beautiful to fill his mind. I wished for him to think of our daughter, our Susanna. He would be with her soon. I wished for him to think of God, of me, of lilies.
When we reached the top of Golgotha, the man who'd carried the crossbeam laid it down beside one of the uprights, and Jesus stood gazing down at it, swaying a little. We women were allowed no farther than a small knoll 20 or so paces from him. A putrid smell pervaded the air, and I wondered if it was the accumulation of all the atrocities that had ever transpired here. I pulled my scarf across my nose. My breaths came in small gulps. Don't look away. Terrible things will happen now. Unbearable things. Bear it anyway. Beside me, the others moaned and wept, but I didn't join them. Later, alone, I would wail and fall to the ground and beat the emptiness with my fists. Now, though, I choked back my anguish and fastened my eyes on my husband. I will think only of him. I will give him more than my presence. I will give him the full attention of my heart. That would be my parting gift to him. I would go with him to the end of his longings. I watched the soldiers strip Jesus.